Hello, everyone. You're very welcome to the first episode in this series of the Marie Keating Foundation Talks Cancer podcast. This series, we are talking breast cancer. In this episode, Director of Nursing Helen Forrestal talks to CNS Niamh Byrne and AMP Carol Spillane from the St. James's Hospital Breast Care Clinic. This episode includes discussions on facts, stats, and background to breast cancer in Ireland, signs and symptoms, when to go to your GP, family history, the National Cancer Control Programme guidelines, and the impact of COVID. We better get started as we have a lot to cover.
Wow, it's great to have you here, Carol, this morning, and Niamh, and we're talking breast cancer, of course. And I'm delighted to have you, two specialists from St. James's Hospital. We couldn't ask for more. So I guess the first thing, we probably need to talk about is just an overview of breast cancer in Ireland, per se. But equally, in globally, there's over 2.3 million women diagnosed with breast cancer. And then if we filter that down, we know that in Ireland, one in seven women will be diagnosed with breast cancer in their lifetime. There's over 3,500 women diagnosed with breast cancer in Ireland. And we're actually going to talk about men here too, aren't we? Because men get breast cancer too. One thing I would like to say before we even go any further is that the survival rates, 5-year survival rate for breast cancer is 88%. So that's a bit of good news, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's on the rise. There's so much research.
Yeah.
You know, the survival rates are improving each year.
Yeah. Niamh, can you tell me a little bit about your role as a clinical nurse specialist in the breast unit in St. James's Hospital?
Sure. So I'm Niamh, I'm one of the clinical nurse specialists in the surgical department of the breast service in James's Hospital. So as a CNS, our main role is kind of to advocate for patients. We're basically the patient's gatekeeper into the hospital. We meet all the patients at diagnosis, so when they get told that they have a breast cancer, and we do a lot of the psychological care afterwards and the follow-up. A lot of people, when they hear cancer, get very, very shocked and don't really take anything else in from the appointment. So we'd be their signpost, we'd be their main contact point. If they've got any questions at home, if they've got questions about their treatment, we'd be the person that they would call. And we'd also be organising your follow-ups. In James's, we do a good bit with kind of organising scan dates and then appointments to come back. But also from the surgical aspect, when you come to having an operation, we go through the operation in detail with patients, what to expect after surgery, how they're going to feel, what it's going to look like, the psychological aspect of having a surgery. And then we do the post-op care as well, checking the wounds, managing the drains. So we're very involved with patients from kind of the day dot and on towards the end of their care.
Okay, so day dot from day of
diagnosis. Yeah.
Okay, so where do you come in then, Carol?
I suppose my role is slightly different to Niamh. I was a clinical nurse specialist for a very long number of years in St. James's, and I've moved on to the advanced nurse practitioner role. So the evolution of that role for breast care started in 2014 with my colleague Yvonne. And it really was, you know, in a way of improving a woman's experience within the department. So you had a very, very specialised nurse who knew an awful lot about breast cancer. And I suppose primarily what we do now is we have done a little piece of research that identified for our ladies that there was inconsistency in the information they were given, depending on who they saw. So we use that information to develop an advanced nurse practitioner role specifically for women who have a high risk of breast cancer who carry a gene.
Okay.
So that's the primary role of the AMPs. But we also partake in the rapid access clinic.
Okay.
And we are going to streamline how we do that in the future, but we would attend the clinics with the consultants. So very often one of the ladies who's diagnosed may have seen one of the advanced nurse practitioners.
Okay, wow, that's brilliant. Lovely to hear that. Such an advancement in nursing, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, so we'll maybe start the journey, I suppose, of a woman who may be concerned, and I might bring her own services into the conversation here. We run a mobile, you know, a community outreach service, but we also do a lot of corporate webinars. So often we'll find, you know, somebody in the community, maybe opportunistic, that might have an issue or a worry. They might have found a lump, or they might not, or they might be just worried that they have a risk of breast cancer. And if they have particular concerns, our nurses who are either health promotion nurses or oncology nurses will actually, you know, have a conversation with that lady or that man, and encourage them to go and see their GP. And equally in kind of the corporate world, you know, if we're doing education around breast cancer awareness, we might have, you know, a woman or a man with a concern, and we would actually then start, you know, a conversation around the importance of actually going to their GP with any particular problems, issues, concerns or worries. I suppose my questions to you then are, when a woman or a man decides to go to their GP, and maybe we'll talk a little bit about the risk factors and what a woman or a man should be looking for or feeling for. We might do that first before they get to the GP. So,
I suppose what I would highly recommend is that, particularly women, that they do a breast self-examination once a month. And ideally try and do it on the same time each month, particularly premenopausally, because you will have changes in the breast tissue that are actually normal depending which of your hormones is active. So if you're doing it at the same time each month, you're going to recognize your breast tissue a lot easier, and you're going to recognize when there's an issue with that breast tissue. I suppose when you're doing the breast exam, I would highly recommend that you stand in front of the mirror first, lifting your hands above your head and looking into the mirror, and your hands on your hips and squeezing your chest wall muscles. Because if there's a change in the fold of the breast, particularly in the skin, if the skin is pulled in, you mightn't necessarily feel that. Mm. And I would advocate that you give yourself 10 minutes, just once a month, to do a proper breast exam. And if you think of your breast like the hands of a clock, so you start at 12 o'clock, nice deep palpation down to your nipple areola complex the whole way around, and don't forget to check underneath your arm. And the more familiar you are with your breast, the more you're going to recognise if there's a change, and you're going to act quicker.
Yeah.
And hopefully then, if there is an issue within the breast itself, the quicker you act, the earlier we can diagnose.
Yeah, there's a real key message there, isn't there? Like, know your own body, isn't
Absolutely.
It? Absolutely. Know your own breasts first.
You are the gatekeeper.
Yeah.
Well, there's only so much we can do for you. The more you know, the easier it is for us to help you.
Yeah. And I'd like to direct our listeners to our website. We have a nice video there. It's animated, you know, around looking and feeling your breasts for changes. So that's mariekeating.ie if you want to have a look at that. And as I say, it's very simple and easy to follow. Now, Carl, you said something there about once a month. You know what? One month goes into another very quickly. So what would your advice be there?
Well, I have this conversation quite a lot in my clinic. So I kind of recommend that you put a little reminder on your phone, you know, and that kind of tips you off to do it on that particular day. Like, it really doesn't matter what day of the month it is. Obviously, you don't want to do it if your breasts are tender with your period. But once it's the same day each month, that's the most important thing. So a little reminder on your phone. Give yourself 10 minutes before you go to bed. Job done.
Yeah. Great. And what are, like, the other thing is, I suppose, looking and feeling, like, just maybe bullet points on what you're looking for, what you're feeling for.
Okay, so obviously you're primarily looking for a lump. You know, breast tissue by its very nature is lumpy and bumpy, particularly if you draw a line down through your nipple and across your nipple, divides your breast into four areas. So the area nearest your armpit is by far the lumpiest, bumpiest area, because we have the majority of our breast tissue there. And it feels, I suppose, for want of a better term, it feels a little bit like bubble wrap. Mm. So, you know, it's continuous lumpy bumpy. Mm. It's not a single little lump. Mm. So getting used to what that feels like is very important. So that's glandular breast tissue. So what you're looking for is a lump that you can define. It doesn't matter whether it's smooth or jagged. It's a lump. It should be looked at. In terms of your skin, then, you're looking for puckering or pulling in of the skin. Even if you can't feel a lump, that's very important. Or a very advanced change in your skin is what we call peau d'orange, which is like an orange peel effect. So your skin is a little bit yellow and very porous. Mm. In terms then of your nipple areola complex, you're looking for a sudden inversion of your nipple and it doesn't come back out again very easily. Or if there's a discharge that's yellow or pink or bloody. They're the main symptoms that you're looking for. And lastly, in your armpit, so if you can feel a little node in your armpit that doesn't resolve, so obviously the nodes can be a result of infection or vaccines, but if it doesn't resolve, you would need to tell your GP about that, and your GP would send you to a breast clinic.
And just tell me, what does a node feel like?
It doesn't feel so. You shouldn't be able to put it between your fingers. So that's usually an infected hair follicle. So a node, as you're pulling your fingers down through your axilla, you know, you can kind of feel your fingers move over a small little lump deep within the armpit, not in the skin.
Okay.
Because that's just an infected hair follicle or a sebaceous cyst. We don't need to see that, but we do need to see something like a node. So a little round, swollen ball.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. And just one final question there, Carl, around, I suppose, risk factors. What should women and men know about the risks of breast cancer?
Unfortunately, we don't know exactly what causes it, but if we take into consideration the fact, particularly for women, you're a woman, you have breast tissue and you have fluctuating hormones that are causing changes within the breast tissue the whole time. And that's why self-breast exam is important. You know, if you're obese, there is research to say that the more weight you have, the higher your BMI, the more risk you have of different cancers, including breast cancer. And I suppose family history is also quite important. Mm-hmm. So whether it is a gene or not, if you have a family history in your first and second degree relatives, so if you have more than one first degree and second degree relative over the age of 40, then that becomes an important factor in your risk factors.
Yeah. I'm hoping that our listeners will know their family history, and if they don't, that they might be asking some questions around that, because, you know, we're meeting women these days who will have known a grandmother and a mother might have died younger with breast cancer. So it's important, I think, for everybody to know their family history. No matter what, you know, in any case, even with cardiac risk.
I would also stress the importance of your mum and your dad, because your dad's genes are just as important as your mum's. So very often when I have this conversation, they focus so much on their mum.
Yeah.
And then when you talk to them about their dad, they're, oh yeah, my dad's three sisters had breast cancer. So both sides are just as important.
Okay, very good. Yeah. So that gets us kind of ready for a GP referral, doesn't it?
It does indeed, yeah.
What happens when they get to their GP?
I suppose the National Cancer Control Programme changed the guidelines for referral to a symptomatic breast unit in April of last year. Mm. So, you know, there's plenty of research done on breast pain without any other symptoms. The risk of having a breast cancer is less than 0.4%.
Okay.
So we don't see patients with breast pain, but they can be referred for a mammogram if they have breast pain more than 3 months. So the GPs all know this, so they can refer directly to a breast centre.
Yeah.
So if you attend, particularly if you felt the lump yourself, your GP will ask you if they can do a breast exam, and they will ask if you're happy to do without chaperone or with chaperone, just as they would in the breast clinic. And if you have a lump, your GP, regardless of how old you are, will refer you to a breast centre for assessment. So like us, they'll examine your breast, both breasts, and underneath both of your arms.
Mm-hmm.
So if you self-present with a lump, you're going to be referred. And anybody over the age of 35 who is referred with a breast lump will be seen urgently in a breast clinic.
And what's urgent, Carl?
Usually within 10 working days.
Okay. Has that changed since COVID, or does it remain fairly much the same?
No, yeah, it's fairly static.
Okay, good.
And usually you are seen within 10 working days.
Yeah.
And I suppose the other symptoms that you might present with, so we don't see, as I said, we don't see breast pain anymore. Mm. You know, anything to do with breasts, so sebaceous cysts and hidradenitis would have been referred to us previously. But again, we have research to show that there's no benefit sending those sort of referrals to a breast clinic, because it takes up slots for women who have lumps. So,
and the GPs are very aware of this now anyway, are
they? Well, yeah, they are. But what happens is when the letters come in, they're triaged by myself or one of the consultants or my colleague Yvonne. And, you know, if they don't meet the criteria, we will send back to the GP with a recommendation of where to refer or what to do.
Okay, good. Yeah, so there's some guidelines there.
Yeah, they're very good guidelines.
Yeah, they are. We abide by them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Even like, when, you know, in the community when we're working, you look at what somebody is actually talking about, what issues they have, etc., and presenting with. Okay, so they've been to their GP now, and they're probably going to turn up in your clinic now, Niamh, are they?
Yeah, well, so they'll come to the symptomatic clinic first, where everybody who has a breast lump, like Carol was saying, would come to. Mm. They'd get a clinical examination, a family history taken, and a full personal history taken as well. And then based on that examination, the clinician will decide what they need. So as Carol was saying, anybody over 35 that comes to a clinic will have a mammogram, regardless if the lump is felt or not felt. And then from a mammogram, they would then go on, if they have any other symptoms that they can see, might have an ultrasound, and sometimes they have biopsies then. Mm-hmm. So that's when I would come into it. The patient would have a biopsy. All the biopsies and all the histology that's taken, so the samples that are taken from the imaging department, are discussed in our multidisciplinary meeting, and then patients have an appointment afterwards. So we try and see people within about a kind of 7 to 10 day period from having a biopsy to giving them the results.
Okay, very good.
I suppose just to let people know what's involved. So like a mammogram is an X-ray of the breast. So it is compression of the breast tissue. So if you haven't had one, so your breast is put between two plates. So it can be quite uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And then an ultrasound is a jelly scan. So it's just to scan doesn't really cause any offence. Mm-hmm. And with the biopsy, so the biopsy, you are given numbing agent. You know, you can attend by yourself, you can drive. So we just numb the area and take a tissue sample.
Okay.
Just so that women know what to expect.
Yeah.
And I guess there is that anxious time, isn't there, between having that biopsy, and we have to acknowledge that too. Any time anybody has, a blood test or a biopsy, there's an anxious time and a natural feeling of
worry.
Worry and concern. Yeah.
And that doesn't go away then. So like Carol was saying, the formulation of the A&P role was found on research that it shows it benefits a woman's journey or a patient's journey through their cancer process. Yeah. But the same thing with the CNS role. The reason that we're there is because there is a benefit. There's a psychological benefit, but also just the experience that patients have through their cancer journey is really helped with having a CNS. So that worry that they have waiting for the biopsy results, and then after having the results and being told they have a diagnosis, you know, it's not very often that you'd come in and have a diagnosis and have a straight treatment plan, because oftentimes we need to do more scans, and knowing you have a cancer and not doing something straight away about it is really anxious time for patients. Yeah.
And Niamh, you mentioned MDT there. Will you explain that a little bit more?
Sure. So the MDT is the MDT are the words for multidisciplinary team. So that's everybody that's involved in cancer care, and obviously specifically with breast cancer here. But we have a meeting, so the MDM, they call it, the multidisciplinary meeting, that happens once a week. And everybody's case is discussed at that. So anybody who has had any breast biopsies, whether it's for cancer or a non-cancer reason, all gets discussed at this meeting. So the core members of the group would be the breast surgeons, so the people who do the operations, the breast medical oncologists, so the doctors that give the chemotherapy and endocrine treatment, the breast radiologists, so the people who do the scans and the images and take the biopsies. The breast radiation oncologists, so they're the people who give the radiotherapy after breast surgery or part of the breast cancer treatment. You'd have the CNS team, so we'd be the advocate for the patients there. You'd have the A&P team as well, so they would input there, obviously the family risk aspect of it, but also they've been in the clinics and seen a lot of the patients.
We present our own patients that we've seen at clinic.
And then, so like I said, I'm the surgical team. There's the CNS oncology team, the A&P oncology team. There's, you know, there's a ginormous amount of people who come. The research team as well is there.
So it's every decision that's made is made by a big group of people. So it's not made by one person deciding a woman's treatment plan. Yeah.
And you know what? That's really reassuring, isn't it? Because I've often met women myself who have concerns that one person is making the decision about their treatment, and they're you know, they might be asking for a second opinion.
Yeah.
And when you tell them about the MDT and the process, they're really reassured by it. So no one person is making a decision here. And I presume the outcome of that would be that the treatment plan is optimal for them at that moment in time.
Yeah, it's very unique for each woman. Yeah. You know, obviously the treatment for cancer is very specific to breast cancer, but each patient's plan is unique.
Yeah.
And it's based on her biology, her lifestyle factors. Everything is considered when making a treatment plan.
So before we go on, so they've had a biopsy now, Niamh, and they've got the result and they've been discussed at MDT. So I'm presuming that there is some other tests on in terms of like what we call staging.
Yeah.
Could you explain that?
So staging scans are done. It's basically to check to see if there's cancer elsewhere in the body. So we know cancer has the ability to spread. The first place we look for spread is the lymph node. So that's what Carol was alluding to earlier when she's saying about checking under the armpits. And oftentimes when women come for a biopsy of the breast, they might have a biopsy underneath their armpit as well if they see any lymph nodes on the ultrasound scans.
Okay.
And we also know that cancer, kind of as it gets to a bigger size, has a more of ability to spread as well. So we have guidelines and kind of tick boxes, if you will, of why we would do staging scans and when we would do it in each patient. And so those decisions would be discussed at the meetings, the multidisciplinary meetings. So the scans that we would typically do would be a CT TAP scan. So it's a CT thorax, abdomen, and pelvis. So that looks at you, all your internal organs to check for any spread of disease. And then we'd also do a nuclear medicine bone scan. So that looks at the bones to check to see if there's any disease in the bones.
Yeah.
And then if there's anything high, you know, a lot of people will come in and have never had a scan before. I think what's really important is, you know, a lot of people who have breast cancer are very well people. So if you have a cyst on your liver that's been there for years and it's never bothered you, we see that and we don't just leave anything. No stone is left unturned. So often scans will lead to more scans. Mm. And it's not necessary that we're worried of a cancer, but there's something there and it hasn't been looked at before. So we have to look at it. So we often do liver MRIs or biopsies, ultrasounds. We might do further MRIs of specific areas in your body, depending on what we find on the CT scans. And not all of them are bad things. Mm. It's just that we need to rule this out just in case.
Yeah.
But then that also leads to extra times waiting for further scans. Mm, sure. Sometimes we do PET scans as well if we're just still unsure. But it could be, you know, it could be 3-4 weeks before a woman has finished or three, four weeks before a woman has finished all her scans before we actually do a treatment plan of what we need to do next.
Okay. Well, that sounds reasonable, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And like in fairness to the CNS team and James, is they're absolutely brilliant at keeping the women informed.
Yeah.
You know, and they will let them, if they're worried, they let them know they're worried. If they're not, they'll explain, like, we found this, you know, we aren't worried about it, but in order to proceed, we need to do this test.
Yeah, so, I think that's really important, isn't it? And we will be talking to, you know, women with localized breast cancer and women with metastatic breast cancer. And like their concerns around being that patient in that space. And sometimes it is about being informed, you know, and it doesn't happen the same everywhere you go, unfortunately.
Yeah.
You know, some women have really good experiences and some people, some women not so, and men as well.
I think communication is key, really, for these women. They have enough worry. So if we can alleviate some of that worry, it is important to keep them informed.
Okay. Now, Niamh, you mentioned PET scan. Can you just explain that to me? Please,
yeah, sure. So a PET scan, so it's, well, I couldn't tell you what PET stands for.
Don't worry about that.
But it's basically a really fancy CT scan where they give you, so they give you an injection beforehand of this special, kind of, it's kind of like a glucose dye, for want of a better word. And basically cancer cells grow, metabolize faster than our normal body cells. So they, in theory, use more energy. Mm-hmm. So they're eating up a lot more of our energy stores, which is glucose or sugars.
Mm.
So a PET scan will highlight the areas in your body that are using the most amount of sugars at that time. And what they call it is PET avid. So it's FDG avid is the type of injection that they give you. And so based on what is highlighted in the scans, the specialist doctors in the radiology team will look at those scans and say, look, that looks suspicious or that. And they can be very minute. So it'd be looking at maybe lymph nodes elsewhere in the body, or they might highlight different lesions that the CT, just the normal CT, couldn't see properly.
Yeah. Okay. So now we've been through the whole MDT process, but I do want to take a step back here because I probably want maybe to talk a little bit about, you know, the breast types, cancer subtypes, and also kind of what the staging and grading is,
what
just
they mean,
quite simply, like, so that we all understand it.
I suppose there's basically two main types of breast cancer. So you've got the ductal cancer and the lobular cancer. There are other types, but they're not as seen as often. And really what that means, it's just where it originated in your breast tissue. So your lobules make the milk and the ducts bring the milk to the nipple-areola complex if you were to breastfeed.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just all the ductal and lobular mean. The subtypes of that, I suppose, so the grading really refers to, I suppose, how abnormal the cells look underneath a microscope. So you have grading 1 to 3. Mm-hmm. So one would be very low grade. They probably, the cells wouldn't look too abnormal or wouldn't look too dissimilar to your normal breast tissue, to grading 3, which means the cells look very abnormal. And that's just telling us, I suppose, how quickly the cells are changing. And that's what the grading means. That's it. And so it's of no significance once you've had your surgery. The staging, on the other hand, so staging is looking at the tumour, the nodes, and whether there's any metastatic disease. So the staging is really the size of the cancer. So again, it goes from 1 to 4. So 1 would be a tumour that's less than 2 centimetres. 2 would be between 2 and 5 centimetres. Mm-hmm. 3 is greater than 5. And then 4 would be where, you know, I suppose you have skin involvement or the tumour is stuck to the chest wall muscles.
Okay.
So that's what that means. And then the end part is, do you have any nodal involvement? So when I say nodes, I mean any of the glands underneath your arm.
Yeah.
And then obviously metastatic disease is, has the cancer gone somewhere else in the body? So is it in the bones? Is it in the liver? And they're kind of the main primary, and or the lungs. They're the three main areas that we would see metastatic disease with breast cancer. They're not the only areas, but mm-hmm. they're the ones we see the most often. Areas.
A lot yeah. of people mix stage and grade up. Yeah, like absolutely. That'd be a lot of questions yeah. that we would
yeah.
get.
Yeah.
Because you wouldn't necessarily know somebody's stage, mm. like final stage, until after surgery when you have exact of sizing
if,
of yeah. things.
If they get to that stage, yeah. absolutely. Yeah.
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 yeah. And I suppose that's important to say as well. It's very personalised, isn't it? And it's very yeah, individual.
I suppose there's other factors that we consider that are really important to the treatment plan, and that's whether the woman's cancer is receptive to her female hormones. So we'd say ER, PR positive, or whether it's negative. You know, if you're ER and PR positive, so estrogen and progesterone positive,
okay. yeah.
what that means is that your tumour is not caused by your female hormones, but it can feed it. So okay. that will be important when we come to your treatment plan. So if you are presenting with that type of breast cancer, you will definitely have endocrine treatment. So anti-hormonal treatment is part of your treatment plan.
Yeah. Okay.
And then the HER2 is a protein that grows on the surface of the cancer cells, and it definitely causes the cancer to grow at a faster rate. So again, if you are HER2 positive, you would need to have a drug called Herceptin, which is an immunotherapy drug. But in order to have Herceptin, unfortunately, you need to have some chemotherapy because it doesn't work effectively without it. So again, it will determine what pathway you embark on when you're diagnosed with your cancer.
Okay.
So there are very important factors for us in terms of treatment.
And then some
planning.
Women, some women's cancers aren't being fed by any Anything. Of those. Right. And they're what would be called the triple negative breast okay. cancers. Yeah. And because you don't have a target to treat, you definitely need to give those patients chemotherapy or at least a discussion about it.
Yeah. yeah. Okay. Gosh, there's a lot to learn, isn't there? And yeah, a lot to know. Yeah.
Like, there's really good reasons why we make treatment plans. And
of course.
All, you know,
yeah.
So the more we know about the biology, yeah. the more.
Yeah. So I'm just going to kind of summarize on what we've talked about so far, because we've talked about quite a lot. So we've talked about, you know, a woman maybe turning up on in a community outreach or from ourselves with a concern. They go to their GP. The GP, if he or she are concerned, will refer on to the rapid access breast clinic or the symptomatic breast clinic.
Yep.
And they'll be seen hopefully within 10 working days if they're triaged as being urgent.
Yep.
And then they go through a process of seeing yourself, Carl, and yourself, Niamh, and actually just, you know, having all the tests that are required, mammograms, ultrasounds, biopsies. And then maybe having further staging with a CT scan of the thorax, abdomen, pelvis. And
can I just interrupt you for one
second? Yeah, sure, sure.
I just want to say one thing in terms of going to a breast clinic with a lump. So on average, we see about 8,000 new women each year.
Mm.
And we diagnose approximately 400 cancers.
Yeah.
So it's important for women who are listening maybe that, you know, not everybody who presents with a lump will be diagnosed
yeah.
with a cancer.
Very good. Yeah.
But it is still very important that if you find a lump, that you see your GP.
Absolutely. Yeah. And particularly post-COVID as well, isn't it? Yeah. Where people
yeah.
maybe have held back a little bit
yeah.
because everybody is so busy. So there's a very strong message there, isn't there? That if you have any concerns, you see something different, you feel
yeah.
something different, that you do go to your GP and you find yourself with Carl and Niamh. And sounds like a fairly reasonable place to be, although we don't want to be there. But again, there's a lot of support, there's a lot of information, and it sounds very, very informative. So
it is, and
yeah.
But the problem is it's an absolute whirlwind for a patient. You
of
know,
course.
If you're not in the hospital setting,
yeah.
a lot of these words are really new to you.
Mm.
And then so you're trying to understand and educate yourself on that. And then we're firing treatment plans and different type of operations or different types of treatments.
Mm.
So it's okay to feel very, very overwhelmed during that time frame as well.
Yeah. And I suppose coming back to then, so a woman or a man has a diagnosis and they're going to go through a treatment plan, and that's going to probably be surgery, maybe
yep.
chemotherapy, radiotherapy and hormone therapy. So will we talk a little bit about that? We don't want too much detail because
yeah.
we know it's very personalised care and medicine.
Yeah, I suppose in terms of the treatment plan, so the biology, as I said, is very
yeah.
important. So as Niamh mentioned, if you're triple negative, you know, you would need to have chemotherapy. So with breast cancer, it's not just surgery. So surgery treats the local area.
Mm-hmm.
You may need radiation treatment that treats the local or the regional area.
Mm.
And then you need a head-to-toe treatment. So if you're triple negative, there's a very good chance that you would start with chemotherapy before your surgery.
Yeah.
That's what we call neoadjuvant chemotherapy. And the same if you're HER2 positive, because you do need to have chemotherapy with your Herceptin, there's a chance, not definitely, but there's a chance that you would start with chemotherapy as your first line of treatment. And when you have chemotherapy, it's generally for about 16 weeks. That's the average, but everybody's different. You'd have a little break of about 6 weeks and then you'd have your surgery. And whatever else comes after that would be determined following your surgery.
Yeah.
The operation, I suppose, would really depend on the size of your tumour as to, is it small and unifocal? Can we just remove that lump with some healthy tissue around it and do a central lymph node biopsy? It's important to say, even if your scan of your armpit doesn't show any evidence of breast cancer, we don't rely solely on that. So as part of your surgery, you would have a central lymph node biopsy. Mm-hmm. And that is where we inject some radioactive material, about five areas around the nipple areola complex that's absorbed by the little lymphatic vessels that bring fluid to your lymph nodes. And during the operation, then we use a special little probe to identify those nodes. We remove between one and three nodes. And sometimes, just for the ladies to know that, if they can't isolate the nodes with the central lymph node, they will inject some blue dye. Mm-hmm. And the only reason you need to know that is you'll be peeing green. And you might have a little blue
that could
twinge.
Be a bit frightening.
Yeah,
if you
yeah. 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 And you might have a little blue twinge off your skin. Mm. So it's either lumpectomy and central lymph node biopsy, or lumpectomy and axillary clearance is where we remove. Mm-hmm. If we know there's nodal disease, we will remove a certain more nodes than central lymph node biopsy. And then obviously, if you have a larger tumour or if inflammatory breast cancer, then we would be looking at mastectomy. So we need to know everything we can about your tumour to decide on the best way forward in terms of your treatment.
Yeah.
The other thing to say is, once you finish each modality of treatment, your case gets rediscussed at the MDT.
Very good.
So after you finish your chemotherapy, so if you have neoadjuvant chemotherapy, so chemotherapy first, we re-image the breast after you finish that, and we rediscuss all those imaging again. So each time you have a treatment, a new treatment plan is made on the information we had before and the information that we have now.
Okay.
That's a really good point. Thank you.
Yeah. No, it sounds like an excellent service. And I'm hoping, as I'm listening to you both, that this is happening in the eight
centres
around
Ireland. Well, they're the guidelines. You know, yeah. MDT yeah. is a core part of breast, the yeah. breast pathway. It's not something that can be missed.
Yeah.
I would hope that it is. I think, yeah. I suppose, breast cancer in a way is, I suppose the area is very lucky because, you know, it's been established for quite a long time and there are yeah. very strict guidelines on, yeah. on how we should manage women. So I suppose I would expect that all of the eight centres would work in the same
yeah,
way.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, and I'm sure they do. But it's just highlighting it, isn't it, for our mm-hmm. listeners that, you know, this is such an excellent service. It sounds very informative and I'd like to congratulate you both on, you know, the work you do there. Before we finish off, though, I'd love to... You know, I'm sitting here and I'm thinking, gosh, I've been through, you know, I've gone through that clinic. I've been through all of this. What now? You know, when women or men come out the other side of completing treatment, I know there's a lot of isolation and even loneliness, yeah. particularly in COVID. Where do you direct your patients or where do they go?
Yeah, well, that's been very highlighted. So we have a survivorship nurse, oncology nurse in St. James's. Catherine O'Brien is her name, and she's excellent.
She's fantastic.
So she works actually with one of our clinical psychologists, Sonia Collier. Mm-hmm. So they've developed a program for women and for men who've been diagnosed with breast cancer, particularly in the area of the fear of recurrence, because obviously yeah. that's very natural.
Yeah.
So it teaches or it helps these men and women to adjust to the new normal, because it's never going to be what it was before. There's yeah. always been that experience yeah. of cancer. Mm. So it's a program that by step teaching you how to cope with your new normal. So for our women and men who do have particular issues in terms of that, we would refer to that program. Now, it's relatively new.
Mm-hmm.
It's running at the moment, but, you know, there will be adjustments made depending
sure.
on the experience of the people as they go through it.
Yeah.
I suppose the more... the people have involved their family. I can't stress that enough because it's so important.
Yeah.
I had a really interesting conversation on Thursday with the lady who's 7 years post-mastectomy. And, you know, I don't know if there's a time period where you adjust to your change in your body image, but she had never, ever shown her husband her scar. And she was so sorry that she hadn't done that now, but she'd got to a phase in her life where she just couldn't do
it. It's hard to turn back.
Yeah. And, yeah. you know, I suppose... one of the things I would have done as a CNS would be to actively encourage the women to involve their loved ones in their care. Now, it's very easy for me to sit there and say that,
mm-hmm.
But it makes that much easier for them later on in their journey.
Yeah.
You know,
I feel like coming from the CNS aspect, so I see them. So those services are fantastic and they're well needed. And I think the Irish Cancer Society also runs...
Thrive and Survive.
Thank you. But from the immediate post-op point and from the diagnosis, like, I will always ask somebody how they deal with stress, how they find their coping is, and who they bring. You know, do you like to talk about your feelings? Because there's so many supports out there.
Yeah.
If you don't like to talk about your feelings, you're not going to start now because you've got a cancer, you know? And it's very hard. I think Irish people in general, we don't talk about our feelings at all. We just, you know, carry on and just bottle it up. So I think a lot of it is that you do engage your family. But if you don't want to talk about your family to your family, you don't want to worry them. A good friend, you know, there's always somebody there that you have. But also the CNS team, that's what we're there for. You know, if you're sitting at home with a worry about something, if I can help with that over a 5 minute conversation, I'm so happy to do that. You know, we're all busy in clinics, but I'll ring you when I have a moment. And if we can go through that, and there's, we will always highlight, you know, the Irish Cancer Society has really good support. They have a nursing phone line. Marie Keating for breast cancer specifically. ARC are fantastic. James's have, you know, we there's supports there.
No, it's fantastic, isn't it? And I want to just highlight there as well, Niamh. I'm really pleased that you say that you'll ring your patients back, because sometimes that little worry escalates into something uncontrollable very quickly if they haven't got a listening ear.
I think we'll say something along the lines of, well, if you're sitting at home thinking, you know, you've got a question that needs to be answered, then you should be picking up the phone.
And we'll do as much as we can to answer. You know, we can't answer every question, but we'll find out. And sometimes even just talking it through, even if you don't have an answer, is helpful. And just on the point of, you know, people thinking at home and worrying, what I often find is patients who have gone through chemotherapy first, you are so focused on being well for your next cycle. And then after surgery, all you need to do is recover. And recovery is rest. So you're sitting at home. And that's when the thoughts, you're sitting there, you can't do anything because you're tired. And that's when the thoughts start going through the head. And that's a lot of women will find that they will actually slump then. They will find that their mental health goes a little bit further down at that point.
Time to think.
Yeah.
And I think you mentioned ARC there as well, Niamh, and maybe just for listeners, no matter where you are in the country, there are cancer support centres. You'd probably find them locally, you know, if you look, or your nurses, I'm sure, will tell you.
Oh, they're
about
all over the country.
There's some great ones. Cushla, Douglas.
They're
everywhere.
They're everywhere.
Yeah, we went to visit Solace last week in Waterford.
So
there is lots of support out there. But one thing I probably would say, even from my own experience, is that needs a conversation too, doesn't it? To get somebody, particularly men, I think, with maybe breast cancer, to get them over the threshold of, you know, a door into a space where they will be very well supported.
I suppose actually I would find, we obviously have male breast cancers in James's, and about 1% of our breast cancers would be male.
Yeah.
And there's this perception that they're all BRCA, so they all have a gene, and that's not true.
Mm-hmm.
So a man who finds a lump, very often it's gynecomastia, which is just a swelling of the breast bud.
Yeah.
It could be related to medication, it could be related to prostate issues. But they should... You know, I would actively encourage a man who finds a lump to present to his GP, and the GP can direct you on what's the best way forward for you.
Yeah.
But I think when men present to us and are diagnosed with breast cancer, they're so much more, they're so shocked. But they're so much more open to looking for help then.
You know,
it's amazing. You can kind of see a shift in comparison.
Yeah.
And like generally, they're older men, but not always. So they are definitely... Well, I suppose they see the support that they get from the clinical nurse specialist. So they're much more open to taking that help, because that's a conversation that the girls would definitely have at diagnosis, would be the supports that are available. So they know from the onset what's out there.
Yeah, that's great.
We always reinforce it, but from the onset they're aware.
Okay.
And the GP is also a good support as well. Sorry, just to mention, we're talking about being in the big hospitals each time.
Yeah.
Like there is, you know, counselling, the community supports out there. So if you are at home worried about something, you know, you have to pick up the phone to somebody, whether it's your family, whether it's us, but also the GP is great support.
Yeah, and we always need to remember that.
Mm-hmm.
GPs are very busy people too, aren't they?
Yeah.
And Carl, for yourself, talking about the family history, I mean, that's a really important aspect too. And I know some people shy away from it.
Yeah.
What's your experience of that, and what would be your message to people?
I suppose, you know, 10% of breast cancers are familial related, maybe 5% are gene related.
Mm.
I suppose my real big take-home message was what I said at the beginning, that your mum and your dad's side of the family count, so don't discount either side. When we look at family history, we only take one side into consideration, so that would be the one with the most breast cancer. And ovarian cancer is also quite important, folks, in terms of your family history. So find out as much as you can about your family history, because that will impact not just your treatment for breast cancer, hopefully, you know, you never have to present with that, but it will impact on what your surveillance should be. So the more you know, the more we know, the more we can give you a unique treatment plan.
And I do want to mention, and I know you would have mentioned it, Niamh, about, you know, women presenting with probably metastatic breast cancer. Unusual enough, like, you know,
it does happen.
It does happen. What happens to that lady or that man?
So that's the reason we do the scans as well. You know, we're looking for, not that we're always looking for disease, we're hoping to outrule it.
Yes.
But if it's there, you know, knowledge is power. We're not going through a completely different treatment plan for somebody who needs something else. So if we were to diagnose metastatic disease, so you'd call it de novo metastatic disease, so somebody who's diagnosed with metastatic disease from the outset, you know, surgery doesn't help in that sense, because you don't need to remove the lump. You need to look after the cancer that's gone elsewhere in the body.
Yeah.
So oftentimes you then go to meet with the oncologist first, the medical oncologist first. And like I said, so I'm the surgical CNS, but there are oncology CNSs, oncology A&Ps, who also support those clinics and are there to support those women. And they would talk to you about what the best treatment option would be. So they normally try to give you something that would go through the bloodstream. Some women who present with, you know, if you've got really bad bony pain, or if you've got, you know, maybe a cancer that's broken through the skin, sometimes they give radiotherapy to help with that as well.
Yeah.
And sometimes we have patients whose breast cancer in the rest of their body has responded. So their metastatic disease has responded to the treatment, but it hasn't gone away in the breast. So oftentimes, and we're seeing a lot more of this because the treatments are so fantastic now, where we're doing targeted treatment. So removing the breast lump, you're having surgery to remove the breast lump, even though you've got disease elsewhere that's just responded to treatment. So not every treatment option is ruled out, but the order and when you have the treatment is changed. And the nature of metastatic disease is that it's spread somewhere else, and we don't go and cut out every bit. So you will be on treatment long term, and, you know, changing of treatment. So there's not an end date. There's a continuation of treatment.
Okay. So living with and beyond cancer.
And
just, there's one final question that came to my mind there, Niamh, while you were talking. And it is for women with localized breast cancer, to manage their minds, you know, the uncertainty of recurrence. But we do know that cancer, breast cancer, can recur. What how do you educate women around that, women and men?
I suppose really around recurrence, it's not trying to focus on it. So, you know, a lot of women would say, well, will I have these tests? Will I have staging tests going forward? And we would say no, because, you know, it doesn't benefit you. It causes you an anxiety each year. So it's being aware of your body. So if you happen to notice a pain in your back, that's new. That's not related to some exercise or something abnormal you've done. You know, if you're short of breath. So if you just notice changes, that you tell your treating doctor, because you will continue in treat or surveillance for quite a long time.
Okay.
So it's just being aware.
Yeah, so the surveillance is really important, isn't it?
And it is, yeah.
It doesn't attending take away from the uncertainty, I suppose.
No.
But
and it's attending for your annual mammogram, because, again, that's important. Or, you know, obviously, hopefully you'll never be in the situation again. But we're doing the surveillance mammogram for a reason. So God forbid, if you are, we catch it at the earliest possible stage.
And I think just to build on what Carol is saying about attending your or telling your doctor, don't wait until your appointment. You know, if you're having symptoms now and your appointment's in August next year, that's too long for us. You know, that's where our phone line comes in helpful as well. If you call us, the nursing team, we'll go through your symptoms. And oftentimes it is like, oh, I actually think that's something you need to go to your GP for. But if it's something that may be related to the breast cancer, we will bring you in sooner. So don't wait for your appointment if you are having symptoms.
Really
give us a call.
Really good message,
yeah.
And I suppose the other thing to mention is Breast Check. So the website is breastcheck.ie. And the number is 1-800-454555. And just make sure you're registered. And when you do get that letter to attend at 50 or just thereafter, please do attend. I think that's really important. So Carl, Niamh, we're finishing up here. I want to thank you so much for your time, your expertise, and obviously the passion you both have for looking after women with breast cancer.
Yeah, thanks very much for the opportunity.
Mm. Yeah, no, it's lovely.
What's your parting message, Carl?
Be breast aware.
Be breast aware. Niamh, for you?
Utilise the nursing team. We're there for a reason. You know, we are busy. Everybody's busy. But like I said, if a 5-minute phone call alleviates that anxiety, it's so helpful. And it actually, it not like we love our jobs, whatever, but it does help. You know, it's nice to be able to help somebody.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
And like, yeah. And like that, it's a question. And people have questions when they go home, they talk to family members. That's when you start thinking about things.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or I would say as well, sometimes, you know, you meet somebody who's been in the position you've been in previously, but it's different to your story. Your story is your story. Yeah. And they try to impart some wisdom on you that freaks you out.
Yeah.
Pick up the phone. Yeah. We'll help you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And don't
Google.
Don't Google, please.
You are unique. Google. Yeah.
Yeah.
And there are support services. Survivorship is really good at 88% after 5 years. We run a Survive and Thrive program ourselves. Yeah. The National Cancer Control Program, or with the cancer support centres in Ireland, run Cancer Thrive and Survive. And we have a positive living group as well for women with metastatic breast cancer. So there is lots of support out there. We just want people to know about it and to actually seek it, don't we? Women, generally speaking, are very good.
Yeah. They are and they aren't, but that's the problem. You know, it is, because if you are at home and you're feeling some kind of way, we don't know unless you tell somebody. Yeah, that's the thing. You have to tell somebody.
I suppose I would say one more thing. One of the side effects of the treatment that we give you to help you with your breast cancer can affect your sexuality and sexual health. Don't be afraid to discuss that with your nurse or your doctor, because there are things that we can do to help you.
Okay, it's a relationship disease, really, isn't it?
Yeah,
it affects.
And that could be a whole different podcast talking about it.
Yeah.
Body image, everything, you know, it is.
We will actually allude to that and talk with the ladies about that actually, because it comes up quite a lot.
I feel like it's getting better, but a lot of healthcare staff wouldn't have brought up those things now. Mm. But we're happy to talk about vaginal dryness, lubricants, vibrators, anything. So it's not something to be.
Okay, well, you know where Niamh is now.
I suppose, you know, even just being able to say to somebody the relief from that.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And we're very mindful of that.
Yeah. Use your teams, guys.
Yeah. Use your nurses, use your teams, use your cancer support centres.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll sign off. Thank you so
you much,
Niamh and Carl.
Thanks a million.
That's all for this episode. Thank you again to our wonderful guests for their inspirational insights and learnings. To our sponsors, Novartis and Roche, for their support in making this series possible. And to you for tuning in. Join us next time, where we will once again be talking all about breast cancer. And in the meantime, you can visit mariekeating.ie for more information on breast cancer awareness and support.